Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, alumni, and adjuncts. The recording you're about to hear is from the 2024 Bendigo Writers' Festival. I was fortunate to be the co-curator of the Bendigo Writers' Festival in 2024, programming a suite of sessions under the La Trobe Presents banner. The festival took place on the second weekend of August on the unceded country of the Djadjawurrung and Tungurung peoples of the Kulin Nation. What happens when a veteran interviewer becomes the interviewee? I turn the spotlight on political journalist, podcaster, and television presenter Annabelle Crabb for a far-ranging and intimate conversation to kick off the gala event of the 2024 Bendigo Writers' Festival. The event included special performances by acclaimed poets Jazz Money and Sarah M. Saleh. Please note, some of these live events may contain strong language. I hope you enjoy.
Marang Yaraya Nindiga, Wiradjuri Yina Baladu, Jazz Yuan Nadi, Jara Nurumbang Warana, Yinjimara, Mandanguwu. My name is Jazz Money, and it is a great honour to be here on Jara country, away from my own homelands on Wiradjuri country. I want to thank Ani for that beautiful welcome and for the smoke at the start for grounding us in this place that has always known story and gathering and celebration and love. My darling friend Sarah Saleh and I have been working on a collaborative piece for you all for this event right now that we've been creating over text over the last few weeks, and we thought we'd premiere it with your blessing. So, shall we?
Let's do it.
It starts on the 22nd of July with a message from me saying, "Sound waves expand infinitely. They never disappear."
And naturally, I just reply with an excellent line myself. "They are resurrection, our ancestors' voices across the city's chest.
Do you hear the blood pounding through these veins? This hard-won inheritance of love.
This freedom, so they split our tongues and told us to remain silent.
Taught us to be beaten, to be small, cupped the hand around our flame.
To the burning smells of empire, in the burial grounds of ancient country, we grew new bodies.
We sprouted feathers and learnt to fly.
We made friends with the sun, glued stars in the sky, became fluent in the language of the tides."
We'll resume the poem shortly. Sorry, lol, but are you here at Byron Writers Festival in this insane villa resort?
No, sad face. My puppy belly hooks had to have emergency surgery. Lil Perv ate my underwear. It's been a fucking traumatic 48 hours. Have a good time for me, though, XXX.
And that concludes the poem.
All right, I'll see you later.
Hopefully you'll welcome us back next year where we can read the completed version. But we thought, in keeping with tonight's theme of up close and possibly way too personal, that that was a nice peek behind the curtain of the creative process. I'm going to read three short poems for you all and then welcome Sarah back onto the stage. Don't worry, you get more of her magnificence. It's not cut short. I'm going to put my phone down though. Don't need any more text poetry. This is from a poetry collection called Mark the Dawn that came out 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago maybe. It's my second poetry collection, but I'm still getting used to reading the poem, so I hope it goes okay. This piece is called "Our Abundance as Though It Were Honey." "Don't tell me of the matriarchs by comparing them to kings. I want to hear that love song with the fire from your belly, about the world our women shaped from the molten rock, washed in the sweet water that collects between them thighs. Did you see the way they raised our homes from the wind? The way they carried our abundance as though it were honey. There are ways that this love makes and unmakes me daily. Blessings that are the tender gift of responsibility. A community carrying ancient all this knowing that to hold is to be held, and so witness how it is carried, this fire burning in the chest. Since the first fires made us. The next piece I wanted to read for you all, I was kind of tossing it up, but it's about my mum. And I wanted to read it because my mum lives in Castlemaine, so I get to come out to beautiful Jarra country quite a lot, and it's a great joy to be here, and it's a great joy to sort of bring my mum onto the stage with me in presence. I wanted to say thank you to the festival for having me on the stage tonight and across the events that are coming up over the weekend, and to say thank you to you all for being here. This piece is called Mama's Onions. My mother taught me how to make the world whole with food. Baby, she said, cooking is how you tell people you love them. So you should do it slowly, and you should do it well, and you should do it every day. There was a time when I was sad and filled my life with the pungent smells of home. Because I was far away from the backyard lemons I knew, and I missed my mother. Every time I chop an onion, I'm reminded of her. Baby, you don't need to dice it finely if you cook it for long enough. Baby, always toast your seeds to release the flavour, and olive oil with butter will stop the butter burning. Food is a language we all speak, so baby, you better make sure the food you make for the people you love is singing. Thanks.
Ah! Love that gentle little mmm that you all gave. That was so appropriate for an onion poem. The final piece I wanted to read for you tonight is very short. It's called Small Soft-Bodied Things. The world is large and loud, and we are small soft-bodied things that lean to the sun as flowers do, guided by the most simple demand. To be here, to continue, to love. To take part in the exquisite mystery with our faces turned to one another, repeating, I do not know, I do not know, yet held together in that enormous promise. Thank you all so much.
I'm not sure I'll be able to live up to those award-winning text messages with the next two pieces, but I will try. I'll be reading from my collection, The Flirtation of Girls. This poem has a mother wound. Will you sermon it? Will you jazz and jive it, swing and salsa it? Will you shoo, shoo, shoo it away, sing it away? Snap it like the strings of a oud. Will you hang your anxieties up on it? Tiptoe around it, build it an altar of crystals, read its horoscope and translate its rising. This poem has a mother wound. Will you wrap it around you the way the sun wears the morning? Will you teach it? Does it have the range? Will you shove a kebab in it? Will you roll it, dough it, sprinkle za'atar on it, serve it up as a snack? Will you lather it thick in labneh, with olive oil, in gasoline? Will you plunge it in the sink with your silverware and fine bone china? Rub and scrub it good. Will you sniff it off like that line of ice on that stranger in the bar's belly? Will you slowly comb through it? disentangle every kink, will you get that mean all over it? This poem has a mother wound. Will you abandon it like every lover you've ever had? Will you keep it chaste like the sermon said? Will you wudu the boys out of your bed? Will you gnaw it to its knees, tame it, taunt it? This poem has a mother wound. Will you zip it up into a body bag, drag it halfway across the city into the pulsing traffic? Will you graffiti the alleys and the lanes with it, scream it in the void, spread it like a purplish bruise across the sky, take it to the place where you learned to keep leaving, the place you cried with your whole body, where you drowned a few times each day so they can see you, so they can see you? Will it set you free? Will you remember to heal it? And what if I wrote the damn poem in search of someone to heal me? The next poem is an ode to my grandmother's building. Ode to my teta's building and the aunties on the balcony and the ash in their lungs, titillating gossip on their tongues, the shisha tubes coiled around their arms like rubber bangles and the unrelenting hand gestures and the bags of dried mint and the green shutters and the basket filled with fresh flatbread swinging from the rails and Dalida's sultry voice bruising the evening. Je suis malade. And all the neighborhood kids pile up like bricks, and there's Depke and Beledi and Khaliji in the driveway, and scooters by the curb, glass bottles and bon juice boxes and chiclets, bubbles and the idioms and the coffee cup readings and the mops and brooms for a deep clean every time there is a spillage, and the curtains drenched in permanent homemade smells of fried beans and onion and incense. Complètement malade. And the electricity cuts. No more Dalida. And the generator whirs, shuttering us on. Won't somebody press play on Dalida? Ma mère sortait le soir. Ode to Teta's building and the love affair he discovered when he walked into her room and the crimson rags discarded when baby Miriam departed and burglars climbing through the bedroom window and you, smart enough to call names of people who weren't there. And shoes off, because this building is communion. This building is an irrevocable condition, and I carry it with me everywhere.
Good evening, everybody. Wow, that's a great crowd. Isn't that beautiful?
And any evening that starts with poetry is a good evening.
I know, it's a good evening.
Don't you think?
I really think so. That's why I curated it this way, Annabelle.
I forgot. I forgot that this was all your idea. Okay, proceed.
So back to me, thank you. I'm the interviewer, remember?
Okay.
I'd like to begin. I don't know how Annabelle would like to begin, but I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we are meeting tonight on the lands of Jarrah people and pay my respects to elders past and present, as well as acknowledging people from other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander country who may be in the audience with us tonight. In the wake of last year's voice referendum, I think it's as important as ever to recognise with respect and ongoing remorse that these lands were stolen and that sovereignty was never ceded. As Jazz said, lest we ever forget that this has always been a place of storytelling and of the sharing of words and ideas. And with the continuing slaughter and starvation of Palestinian people, Let's also recall the words of the great poet Maya Angelou. The truth is, no one of us is free until everyone is free. Can I also say, as a Jewish Australian myself, remind people that criticism of the military actions of the State of Israel does not necessarily equate with anti-Semitism. Thank you all for joining us here tonight, which is basically, this whole event amounts to Annabelle and I struggling to find time in our diaries to catch up. So we thought, well, let's do it at the Bendigo Writers' Festival on stage in front of 500 people.
This is a massive escalation, I think. So our friendship is entirely based on running into each other at writers' festivals where we gouge out a tiny bit of time and go, gabble, 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 and then we don't see each other for 6 months or however long. And so now... Mm-hmm. I see that you've incorporated this into a programming plan, which is,
I know,
it's bold. And can I say that we have had no discussion at all about what this is going to be. And given that my preference is to be in that seat, and like I said, I'm feeling a bit jangly anyway, a feeling which has been absolutely exacerbated by the fact that I've been stuck at Adelaide Airport for 6 hours going, I am not going to make it. So massive thank you to Janine and Wayne from the Bendigo Writers Festival, who fished me out of Terminal 3 and drove me here like legal bats out of hell and dropped me at the stage door minutes ago.
Literally.
Can do.
Okay. This is the fact us truth. Annabelle was on the tarmac in Adelaide at 3 p.m. this afternoon.
I was. A little sweaty. But okay.
And look at her now. All right, so this is the bit where you'd normally do an introduction of the person that you're interviewing.
That's
you all know her. Annabelle is a press gallery journalist, an author, a television writer and host, an election night analyst, a columnist, a podcaster, draws breath, a mother of three, a partner to Jeremy, a devoted daughter, a passionate friend, and a total spunk. Just had to say that. I kind of feel like, as the interviewer, you in that chair, that this is kind of like this is your life, okay? But we're not going to do that because we didn't have enough money to bring other people to come and talk about you onto stage. It's a rural writers' festival.
You could have, my dad would have driven here. You know, my dad heckled me at the Sydney Writers' Festival while I was on stage interviewing Ann Patchett.
That's true. True story. I was there and I heard him. Everybody heard him.
Yeah.
That night.
Hasn't read a book since 1982, and that was like the Foot Rock Flats Christmas compendium. Still perfectly fine to interrupt me as I'm interviewing Ann Patchett. Oh. That's what we're dealing with here.
So it's not This Is Your Life, but I thought we would start by going back in time.
Okay.
Okay? So this is what I was thinking, Annabelle. I was thinking that a lot of women of a certain age, i.e. our age, start to think about their inner child. I think it has something to do with our actual children getting to be old enough to wipe their own bums and maybe do their own washing. So, you know, like 25, 30. And I think that part of looking forward to a future that doesn't involve looking after other people 24/7 somehow seems to involve looking back to past selves. So I want you to introduce us to your inner child. What does little Annabelle look like?
Actually, I was discussing this with my mother in the last couple of days. Little Annabelle got packed off to school at the age of 4, i.e. like really 4, not sort of nearly 5, because I was unbearable. And even though I'm adorable now, I was a nightmare. So I was the middle child, had an elder brother, and a younger brother, and I grew up on a sheep and cereal crop farm on the Adelaide Plains, the sort of really flat and dusty bit, sort of below the Gordia line, sort of arable but sort of just. And so I think I lived not in isolation, but I couldn't walk next door to visit my friends or whatever. I kind of was bored. And so my mum once in an absolute like moment of probably too extreme honesty said to me, well, look, it was a question of either just finding an appropriate child psychologist or sending you to school, and school was easier. So I was too young for everything all the way through, and I ended up being at university when I was 16, which was like a disaster for, you know, kind of, you know, doing anything fun. And then I met Samantha Maiden, and that made things a lot worse. Anyway, I'm skipping forward. So I would say that I read a lot. I really liked school a lot. I was terrible at sport. I read Watership Down, and I thought that I could speak rabbit language. That's true. We had a lot of rabbits at the time because it was pre-Khaleesi virus. And when myxomatosis wasn't really working. So I genuinely spent a bit of time wandering around actually using vocabulary from Watership Down, convinced that I was able to communicate with rabbits. I don't know, is this the sort of stuff you're looking for?
It absolutely is, because I want to ask you, are you fond of little Annabelle? Do you feel protective towards her?
Yeah, yeah. She was a little weirdo. But, like, I still really like her, you know. And the thing is, when you grow up in the country and on a farm, I mean, like, I just got around in hand-me-downs and, you know, and I, even though I was a big reader, I wasn't a very discriminate reader. Like, so I was actually obsessed with reading Reader's Digest magazines. So, like, if you ever, you know how, like, you have country fates, the best thing ever, like, or the gala day at school, you know, and somebody would have a book stand there, I would just go and, like, an entire bag full of Reader's Digest. I fantasized about the day that I would write in one of those sort of, you know, laughter is the best medicine kind of entries and win $50, which I never did.
You can have another crack here, because there is a big secondhand bookstall as part of the Bendigo Writers Festival. Everybody get down to it, including you. Don't go to the Reader's Digest first. Leave them for Annabelle. So you wanted to skip forward then, and that's what I'm going to do next, okay? I want to fast forward to 1990.
Time for the guru.
Bob Hawke is Prime Minister.
Yep.
For his fourth term, just.
Yeah.
Bill Hayden is the Governor General. John Bannon is the Premier of South Australia. Don Dunstan is the state's Governor General. Fred Hollows is the Australian of the Year. But also, Carmen Lawrence had just become the first female Premier of Western Australia in February, and then Joan Kerner followed her in Victoria in April.
Uh-huh.
And Jennifer Kite was the first female solo newsreader. Don't you love Google?
Yeah.
When you do that 1990 in Australia thing? Okay.
Yeah, I do like that, yeah.
So I'm choosing 1990 as the year to take you back to, because that was the year you turned 17.
Yeah.
And I have a bit of a theory that girls are their most empowered, their most ambitious, their most emboldened selves at 17. And then they start to become women, and then they start to kind of lose all their girl power, like patriarchy is like kryptonite. I want to ask you...
I've got a 17-year-old daughter right now.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you...
She's terrifying.
Exactly. Mine's 19, so I've just been through it. I want to know, Annabelle, from you, what your 17-year-old self saw when you looked out at the world around you. I've just given you a little snapshot at it, but what did you see when you looked at the world around you? And what sort of mark did you want to make on it?
I would say that at 17, I was just insatiable. So, I mean, so I grew up in the country. As you know, I won a scholarship to a school, like a girls' school in the city. So all of a sudden I went from like essentially living in a haystack to living in the city, surrounded by all these chicks, some of whom knew each other. Like, you know, I was just like, whoa. It was a very big pivot for me. But the other thing was sort of like academically, it was very, you could just do anything. I mean, it was, there was a lot of stuff on offer. And I think I really jumped into all of that. And going to university, which was, you know, that was, you know, 1990 was me just rolling around in university, was like that. I think all I can think of really is not really an inner life. It was just this sort of grabby kind of more everything, please, sort of thing. And I think it's possible that this sort of excited absorption of all of this sort of academic challenge and opportunity made me feel a bit invincible mm-hmm. and a bit unembarrassable mm-hmm. and a bit sort of entitled to any kind of knowledge that I could scrape up. So I probably was an idiot, but like I really felt a bit amazing. And I would say that one really important thing that happened to me at around about that time was that all of the reading that I did when I was a kid and like things that I read too early and didn't quite get. And I mean, I used to go to the Manopara Public Library and just like scrape shelves into my bag, you know. And I remember that time being the first time I started reading not indiscriminately, like actually reading things and thinking, oh, this is good. I couldn't tell beforehand. Like people say, oh, this is an amazing book. And I can't tell the difference between amazing and not amazing.
That's what I like with wine.
I'm still like that with wine, yeah. But now I'm better with books. And like, and the thing that really I remember, the thing that really made me think, oh, this is objectively great, and I think I sort of understand why, was actually reading Frank Morehouse, like reading those short stories. You know, like I picked up, like, I don't know, the Electrical Experience or the Coca-Cola Kid or one of those collections of short stories, and I just thought, this is amazing. I've got to find other things that this person's written. Mm-hmm. And part of it, I think, is because a lot of that sort of country town life stuff really just was exactly the sorts of things that I was interested in observing myself about the people around me in the place where I grew up. So that was a pretty good moment, just sort of thinking, oh, actually, I can tell the difference.
You describe yourself there as insatiable at 17 and invincible. Do you feel like those qualities about yourself remained? Were you true to them as you went forward in your life?
Oh, look, I think I probably, you know, I kind of didn't know what I was going to do with my life, so I kind of started a law degree.
Because you were a smart girl and that's what smart people did.
Yeah, and I also wanted to be at uni longer.
Yeah.
And that just sounded like it would take ages, and it did.
Did you finish it?
Yeah, I did, mate. My law degree is in pristine condition.
I didn't get past first year.
It's never been backed out of the garage. Not a scratch on it. One lady driver. Anyway, I didn't do the articles thing or whatever. But actually, I mean, see, survey says that was a waste of my time because I never became a lawyer. But actually, I bloody loved studying law, and it was really just because, I mean, apart from the really tedious ones, like the interesting subjects would be, because they're based on case law, in the lectures you'd hear the stories of these bizarre circumstances that had brought about some case that's changed the law of Australian, you know, I mean, common law, right? And so, you know, the story of Grant and Australian knitting mills, which is this case that has changed the course of Australian labelling laws, right? And this is the case of this, it was in the 1930s, and it was a doctor in Adelaide who went to a department store and he bought a packet of two sets of long underwear, woolen long underwear, and as was the custom at the time, he wore the first pair for a week and then he got a horrible rash and he thought, what's going on here? And then, like, it was bad. So bad that he got hospitalised and he got horrible scarring, and then he tried the other pair, same thing happened. And this is the thing about the common law, right? Like, most people would be like, wow, this is embarrassing, I've got a rash on my willy. But this guy's like, I'm suing not just the department store but also the manufacturer. And then he appealed it and appealed it and appealed it, and it went all the way to the Privy Council and he won. And that is why, because he argued that it should have been pre-washed. And whatever chemicals they used to treat the blah, blah, they should have said on the pack. And the Privy Council went, yeah, mate, they should have labelled your undies better. And so that's why we have, you know, this labeling. That's where the labeling regime started. I just think, what an amazing story that, you know, that a person would be that much of a kind of, nah, mate, I'm going all the way with this one. I love that guy.
So at what point did you realise?
I think he was dead by the time the final thing came down. But like,
doesn't matter.
Sorry.
So is Eddie Mabo. So what? At what point did you realise that possibly you might be a better storyteller than a solicitor?
I did not realise that. I did not realise that, my friend. I just thought, I'm not good at this. I must be a bit of a loser.
You think you weren't good at it?
No. I knew that I wouldn't be good at law. Like, yes. I was sort of like, oh. I mean, yeah, people around me were going off and getting sort of summer internships and things. I'm like, that sounds like zero fun.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I quite like studying it. I don't want to, okay. Like,
so you're
everything
like
I hear about the
challenge.
Doing of it sounds a lot yeah. less fun okay. than the study of it.
So that,
but yeah. I didn't really, like, I didn't think, oh, I wonder why that could be. Or, like, I just sort of thought, oh, I might be a bit hopeless at this thing that I've decided somehow to do because I couldn't think of anything else. And at the time I was working at a service station, which I enjoyed, and I just thought, what am I going to do when this law degree runs out and I no longer have an excuse for sort of, you know, being in the world? And then a friend of mine who was a journalist at the Advertiser, who I didn't know very well, just said, you should go and sit the cadetship exam. You'd be a good journalist. I'm like, well, all right, I'm not doing anything that day. And then I got a cadetship and I did a one-year cadetship at the Advertiser because I already had many degrees. And I'm like, honestly, about 3 days in, I was just like, oh, why didn't I think of this before? This is obviously what I want to do. So, I mean, very lucky, but not very well planned, I would say.
So was it the bowerbird nature yep. of journalism that you liked?
Yep. So I understand
that
a lot.
Scraping that you described with
yeah.
your arm before?
You never know what you're going to get when you have a good scrape, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if you all agree with this, but I think if you grow up in a country town or a regional area, you just sort of get used to just taking people as you find them a little bit, and you don't get, because you can't really choose who you hang out with the way you can in the city, you know, you're like, well, you know, my children will be friends with this person's children, which is, you know, important. You should never let children choose their own friends. But like, but I don't know, you just kind of go, there's a little bit of like, oh, that's Roger, he's crazy. He's not that bad. Like, I don't know, you sort of take the crunchy with the smooth a little bit. And I think that's pretty good. It's a good characteristic to have for journalism as well. And I also, because I have a chaos brain, I get freaked out about the idea of doing the same job every day, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I filled in on afternoon radio, like drive for Richard Glover in Sydney once for 2 weeks or something. And like Richard Glover's one of the most profoundly gifted driver slot broadcasters I've ever heard. Like, he's been doing it for a million years and he still sounds every talkback call just like it's the first conversation he's ever had, just fully engaged. Oh, is that right, Gladys? You know, like, it's just, and honestly, I filled in for 2 weeks and I'm on day two, day one, I'm like, oh, this is amazing. I've got producers. Oh, get me a dung beetle specialist. Oh my God, this is so cool. And then day two, I'm like, what, we're going to do the traffic again? We just did the traffic. I've got to be here at the same time tomorrow. What are you talking about? Like, I like the day to surprise me. And that's what's good about politics because, you know, sometimes the day's not always going to delight you, but, you know.
You never know what's going to be happened by
you
the
never,
end of
the
day. You get up in the morning.
You never do.
Annabelle, I want to talk about you being a Renaissance woman. Meaning not that you've been around since about the 16th century.
I feel like I've been around since the 16th century.
But that you do a lot of stuff across a lot of genres. All right.
See my earlier remarks.
So I am going to go through a couple of your mediums. And let's start with podcasting.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Chat 10 looks 3.
Clang. Thank you very much, Janice.
Go. Very good. For those of you who don't know about Chat 10 Looks 3, it's an independent podcast in which you and your mate, Lee Sales, discuss books and film and culture and cooking and your first book together. This is a writer's festival, plugging it. Well, Hello was published in September 2021. And clearly it's been phenomenally successful, yeah? It's a phenomenon in itself. You've got tea towels now and you've got the merch and live shows. Yeah.
And we just did a show in London for our 10-year anniversary where we got Marina Hyde to come along. Oh my God. It was a life highlight.
Your fans, clearly you have some of them here today, call themselves chatters, like Swifties or bikies. Just less glitter and leather.
And we don't sell flashing bracelets that start fires in bins and dumps. It's in our constitution.
When you and Lee started sitting around on your iPhone around a table, I do remember that's how it used to be. Like,
yeah, it's terrible.
Just get around and
back and forth.
Backwards and forwards to each other. And you were just basically recording your nattering as an excuse to get your friend with you in the kitchen, basically, and have a chat. What did you think was going to happen next?
Well, I don't think either of us really had any idea. And essentially it was that we knew that we would like to do something together. We got along very well. We have very different brains and quite different personalities, but we take an enormous amount of pleasure in each other's company. And
sorry, putting a pin in that for a second.
Yeah.
Does that mean she doesn't have a chaos brain?
She does not have a chaos brain.
Yours? Okay.
This lady has a spreadsheet of her outfits. Now, obviously, when she was on 7:30, that's, you know, because you're... But she still does it. Can I just say that there is nothing that would induce me to plan my outfits on the street? I don't even know how to do a spreadsheet. I don't know how to open a spreadsheet. When I hang around with sales, I have to put my phone face down on the table. This happens with my partner, Jeremy, as well. And it's not because I'm having an affair. It's because... If you look at the thing of my phone, it says 232 missed calls, 1,575 unread text messages, and unopened emails, 38,900. So there's some big numbers on there, baby. And Jeremy and Lee are both 000. Yeah. Like they're, right? And in fact, sometimes...
They're probably one of those people that delete them off their phone after they've...
Oh, the whole horror show. I mean, I'm just like... I'm intrigued. I'm anthropologically interested, but I will never do it myself. And maybe it's why I'm a good match for both of them. But also Lee is sometimes like, am I Jeremy? Am I think you might be. And they get along. They love talking about dates and planning and like, what should we, you know, where should we? Ugh. Where were we? Oh, yeah. So when we sat down, I just knew that, like, she's just always interesting. You know, she's always read something interesting and she'll be like, oh, I read this interesting thing, and then you start talking and then it was like talking to you. Like, I feel like I'm getting a free download from somebody else's brain pan, and to me that feels like just money for jam. Like, why wouldn't you do it? And so... I think we knew we wanted to do something together. She wanted to, like, write a sitcom or a musical. I'm like, no. So we eventually, like, the literal least we could do was to do a podcast, but neither of us knew how to do a podcast. So we just, like, voice memoed a sort of conversation and then, you know, put it up on Squarespace. And with the assistance of Lee's then husband, Phil, who quit in disgust because of our lack of commitment to sound quality in the end. Bless him. Thank you, Phil. Sorry. And we were like, oh, we're doing a culture podcast. This is what we're doing. And then we couldn't work out to see how many people were listening to it, if anybody was. We didn't even know. And then after a while, like after 6 months or something, sales noticed that she gets approached in the street quite a bit, even though she's a real gun at going like low profile. Like she puts a terrible set of athleisure wear on and like a baseball cap, and sometimes people don't recognize them. But when they did, they would come up and some of them would be like, oh, I love 7:30, but some of them would be like, oh, I love your podcast. And she was like, people who come up and say I like the podcast are very different. Like they'll come up and give you a hug and be like, I've got some thoughts on, you know, bunk cakes or whatever. Different from the 7:30 people. And so she was like, oh, I think there might be like quite a few people listening to this. I'm like, well, how would we find out? Turns out there are lots of ways you can find out. And then we kind of have just sort of, I guess, described an arc of improvement sound-wise, production-wise, and, you know, and I don't know, this whole thing where there's now this big Facebook group, I don't even know how to use Facebook. I'm not a big Facebooker at all. I find it a bit overwhelming, but I do like that one page, that group, which is all the chatters, because I don't know, there's just some incredible people in there. And because of our jobs, we've sort of made a rule early on that if this Facebook group is going to be in our name, you can't have an argument about politics in there. We both work for the ABC. There'd be forms up the wazoo for years. Like, neither of us would have enough living years left to fill out the forms. So we're just like, shut up, go somewhere else to argue about politics. And that was sort of accidentally kind of a cool thing to do, because everybody knows that you go there to, like, do other stuff, which is sort of a bit of a relief, I think, in some ways.
So what's your beat on why it's been so popular?
Well, we thought it was because of our sort of penetrating insights into cultural, you know, literature or whatever. And then what we worked out probably a bit later than we should have was that actually it wasn't really about books, and it was really more about friendship. Mm-hmm. And the people that we hear from all the time, and I can't tell you how much this moves me, actually, and it even moves Sales, and she's got a heart of granite. So, but, like, just we hear a lot from people who are sort of dislocated in some way, like people who are overseas and, like, missing home, people who are working shift work, people who are sick or in hospital or unable to sleep or worried, new parents who are up in those endless middle-of-the-night kind of hours. Truckies, you hear a lot from truckies, people who drive a lot from work. And it's just so cool. Like, you hear from a disparate group of people who what they really want to kind of check in for is the feeling of just heaping shit on your mate, like, with a rough kind of guideline of talking about a movie or something. Because, like, we don't really plan, like, seriously, we spend probably an hour a month making that podcast. Because we're now in a studio. So we'll go there and do two, because it's easier. And we'll have a little list of things that we've read or whatever. And sometimes we won't get to any of them, because we'll get to item one and then just fang off somewhere. But isn't that the nicest thing? Like, and even though, and this is the secret, I guess, of, this is one thing that I've learned about working in the media, is, like, content creation is, like, such a weird, witchy sort of thing, because if you ask me to create an hour of podcast content by myself a month, it would take so much work. But it feels like reverse work with Sales. Like, sometimes we'll turn up and we're both really stressed and we can't really afford the time, but at the end we'll just feel like we've been at a spa, because when you catch up with your mate and just, you know, laugh like an idiot over something, it actually feels like a day spa. And I mean, this
you do it with wearing just a towel around you and a towel wrapped around your head.
Yes, you should. Actually, we you do. But you know, and here's the point where Sales reminds everybody that we are not best friends. She's got an actual best friend that's not me. This is something she makes clear. This is something she makes clear in a, like, actually quite insulting number of interviews. So I'm just popping it in there, just like, we've got other best friends, guys.
Hang on, but so you've got a best friend too. It's not like a sad situation where she's got a best friend, but you...
No, it's not. I've totally got a best friend. Okay. Her name's...
Good.
Hyacinth. She's great. No, it's not. I mean, I don't know. Do you have a best friend? I don't, you know, I've got a real, like, core of, like, old, close, good friends. Mm. Sometimes from different chunks of my life. I wouldn't want to put them in a race against each other. Like, there's my oldest friend, Wendy Sharp, who I write cookbooks with, lives in London. So I've had to really out, like, I can't rely on her for being the day-to-day best friend, but she's my oldest best friend. So, like, you know. Move along.
No, it's very good. I just thought, oh, that's a nice segue. I'm going to take that one.
Sure,
books.
Off-ramp. Let's do it.
My next category of your Renaissance-ism is books. Yep. At last count, you've published 10 books. Including The Wife Drought, A Case for Why Women Need Wives, Stop at Nothing, which is an investigation into the heart of Malcolm Turnbull's darkness, losing it about the culture of the Labor Party, and you've got a couple of quarterly essays and a couple of cookbooks.
Yep.
Just reminded us. Now, this is a writer's festival, and
I'm currently writing a book about politics for kids.
Like, oh, are you?
Like, you know, year six type students. So, yeah.
Oh, let's talk about that later.
We can.
As an ABC columnist and a long-time journalist, you clearly know how to write. But I want to know what long-form fiction means. Sorry, long-form non-fiction means to you.
A lot.
Like, what place does it hold in your canon of endeavour?
A really significant place. And I think I love essays. And I think if I think about the, you know, when you're starting out as a writer and you kind of know the stuff that you like and then you try to copy it with disastrous results, which is like, it's just, it's like being a toddler. You've got to get through that stage and it's embarrassing and messy and you don't want to look back at it at all. But I think
It's the possums. They're big in Bendigo.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. It reminds me of that great story of Julia Gillard's about, because she moved into the lodge after every prime minister before her had really kicked the lodge repair issue down the road. Like, nobody wanted to, like, be the PM who spends money fixing up the lodge. And she's just like, fellas, this place is an absolute toilet. Like, and it literally was a toilet because there were possums living in the roof and she was showing someone around once, showing them some, like, unbelievably valuable artwork that was borrowed and hanging on the walls, and a little stream of possum piss, like, came down the wall, and she's just like, that's it. I'm fixing up this place. Anyway.
Folks, we got to that place because there's actually quite a scratchy, loud noise above us here that sounds like really big possums are running up and down the road.
There are no
You
possums.
Might not be able to hear them.
Okay. Yeah. It's in your head, Claire. Just nobody else.
It's been a busy
possums.
Few days.
Yeah. So...
back to books, long-form fiction.
Long-form
non-fiction.
So I think I remember like a good friend of mine at uni gave me or introduced me to the like essays by Martin Amis in The Moronic Inferno and Visiting Mrs. Nabokov, which, you know, I kind of was fascinated by his facility, which is shared by, you know, that same gang of writers, you know, Julian Barnes in his Letters from London. And, you know, I got right into that form because I loved this idea that you could take a sort of a good brain into any situation, whether it was chess or, you know, what happened to Lloyd's of London, and just apply a sort of a thirsty mind and a good turn of phrase to sort of tickle something out of it that people who normally write about that stuff don't necessarily do. And I still love that kind of approach. And I now realise that it reflects my own short attention span. But, like, it's one of the cool things about being a journalist, I think, is that you accept that it's okay to be stupid. Like, not stupid, but ignorant. Like, you go into something, you're like, I know nothing about this. Hi. I have one day to absorb as much as I can about this and then chew it up in my brain with my new expert status and then, crucially, remember what it's like to know nothing about that thing and then write a good piece for that person, which is kind of like a real steeplechase to go through. And I think it's one of the most important things you can learn as a journalist is not to be embarrassed about not knowing what you're talking about. And then, once you know what you're talking about, not be so full of yourself that you can't, that you're just kind of showing off to other people who know what they're talking about.
So nothing like being an academic, basically.
Academics terrify me. When I was writing The Wife Drought, basically my nightmare was just the thought of Barb Pocock reading it. Like, it was just, because I was, you know, research and stats and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm interested. I think I've got an interesting idea, but what if I just look like the greatest idiot.
Now anyway. She's in politics.
She is in politics, yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, I don't know. Researchers, for me, have like, and academic researchers just have such a special place in my field of affection. I just, you know, people who take the time to find out in a really detailed way about this one thing so that lazy shits like me can like swoop in and just like cherry pick their work, which is unforgivable in some ways, but also, like, I mean, I love that that happens. And I think, I mean, and historians, if they're doing it right, and I think you do it right, and this is what I love about your work, and what we, my first encounter was with Claire was reading your book about Eureka. And from the first page, I mean, I really opened that book and I absorbed the premise. And I'm not joking, I actually got goosebumps. I just thought, this is the book that I want to read, you know, taking a historical event that we've been bored to death with, or we were in when I was a child at school, and going, okay, who's missing from this picture? Maybe we'll try putting back in.
This is what she does. I appreciate that. But you see how she's drawing the attention away from her by putting it back onto me, which is like what Kathy Lett says about, that's what women do. They're human wonder bras. They uplift and poke each other out or something. She says it better than that.
I think you're buying the wrong bras, mate.
No, I'm going to show you. Kathy Lett, she does say that. All right, let's just go to the last category of your output, television. Kitchen Cabinet, Misrepresented, The House, the Back in Time for Dinner series, yep. Tomorrow Tonight. Television has made your face a household name.
Which is terrible because it means that people recognise me more than I recognise them. So I'm in a constant state of social anxiety because someone will come up and smile. I'll be like, oh, are you my cousin that I've forgotten? Or are you like, hi? It's terrible.
So what I want to know about that is, do people take you more or less seriously?
I don't know.
Because you're a television presenter. Because clearly you're a smart chick, but television, like we think of, is kind of dumb.
Well, also, I cook on television, yeah, which is just the worst thing as a lady that you can do.
Yeah.
It's amazing because, yeah, like, I've been a political reporter for 25 years, yeah, right? Like, I'm good at it.
Yeah.
And I remember shit. I'm not an idiot. Like, and yet, I get a lot of this on social media, which is why I don't really look all that much because it's just repetitive. But, like, I get a lot of stuff from blokes, which is like, you know, get back in the kitchen. Not get back in the kitchen as in that's all that women are good for, but it's like you're a sort of fluff head that does giggling interviews in the kitchen. I'm like, okay, buddy.
Yeah.
All righty. And it's amazing. Like, if I had a beer every time I got that in a given day, I'd be a very drunk person. And I don't know. It's just interesting. I find it interesting. I find it anthropologically interesting.
Okay, but does it annoy you? Does it piss you off that people trivialise you and your clear intelligence because you baked a souffle once?
I have a pretty okay time, you know. Like, I'm not, it's not like there's a lot of people that get worse stuff than I do, right? Yeah. So does it interfere with my enjoyment of life? Absolutely not. I mean, it probably did for a bit, but I think, you know, I know what I'm good at, and I'm really good at the stuff that I'm good at. So I don't really care. I just, there is something about, and this is what I'll tell you about, like, the thrill of turning 50. I don't know if it's not the number. It's partly like where you've got to in life, and you just think, oh, I don't care at all what you think. Just not even a tiny bit, mate. Like, I know it's not like I'm a lunatic who doesn't kind of care about what anybody thinks. I care a lot about what people who I respect think. But also, I've got really good at just going, do you know what? You are a fraud, and I don't care what you think because you're a fraud.
I saw a meme the other day that said what the zero stands for in 50 is zero fucks.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah. But also, it's sort of like a little bit like, you know, by the time you get to my age, like, you've had some hard things happen to you in your life as well. And, like, I've had a rough couple of years because, as you know, like, my brother died a couple of years ago and then my sister-in-law died. There was a lot of death going on. It wasn't good. And when you first actually said, oh, you know, thinking about your childhood self, I have thought about all of that in the last couple of years a lot because my brother took his own life. And that is a very confronting thing that makes you look back on a lot of things, and it's a very painful process because you ask yourself all of the questions that, you know, I mean, hard ones. Mm. And so, but you also, I think, you get to a point where you can't really go any further unless you forgive yourself and others for all sorts of things. And there is something extremely empowering about that.
Mm-hmm. That actually leads me to a question. Charlotte Wood, you would know her books, obviously. We haven't got her at the festival. Her book, Stoneyard Devotional, she has a thing about rooms. You know that passage she's got? And this is what she says in that. I'm just going to read it to you. She says, "When I think about the phases of my life, it is a series of rooms behind me, each with a door to a previous room left open, behind which is another room and another and another. The rooms are not quite empty, not exactly dark, but they are shadowy and indistinct shapes, and I don't like to think about them much. When I hear the name Helen Parry, I think of those rooms furthest back, in the deepest shadows." Do you have a room that you don't want to go to, Annabelle?
Oh, heaps of them, I'd say. But I've got a lot better at opening the doors, I think. And partly it's like if something terrible happens. You know, like you go through your life dreading something terrible happening. I was talking to this friend of mine the other day about Alice Munro, because I've been thinking a lot about Alice Munro in the last, obviously, I mean, you know, since this sort of news emerged about this terrible thing that her husband did to her daughter and the way she responded. And so many women I know who are obsessive Munro fans are like, I can never read her again. And I feel exactly the opposite, which is so weird, isn't it? I want to read all of the stories again.
With that in mind?
Yeah.
With the new information at
because
hand?
Because I think that one of the things that I always loved about Munro, and I think that it's connected to the general status that she has, particularly among female readers, is that she saw women in a way that other writers haven't, or with a sort of an insight. And I think what I like about her is that she doesn't turn away from difficult things or pain or like really complicated characters and characters who are complicit in something dreadful that's been done, who are in a caring role and don't do the right thing. So there's nothing about reading Alice Munro that ever made me think of her as a massive paragon of morality. Like, I just sort of thought the strength of her was that she could level a gaze at these terrible things that human beings do to each other in private, you know, behind closed doors, and write about it and just keep digging and digging, even when it was super painful. And it's interesting. I mean, I think the only extent to which I feel sort of let down in any way by her is that she obviously turned away from someone very close to her who was in a lot of pain, and that is
her daughter.
Yeah, right. So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of challenging stuff that comes up when you love a writer, and then things that, you know, can't come out about that writer challenge your perception of them. Mm. I mean, you know, I went and saw you talking to Anna Funder about George Orwell. I know that there's, you know, a lot of people who love Orwell reading that book and going, I don't know, that book doesn't make me admire Orwell as a writer any less. I sort of don't need writers to be unimpeachable.
There you go. There's the quote line, writers are not unimpeachable. Hashtag Bendigo Writers Festival. Yeah. Obviously, we could keep doing this.
We could. We've got a lot of rooms to go into.
We got a lot of rooms.
This house tour isn't even begun.
No, I know. And believe me, I've got them there to go into. But I am aware of the time. And I'm also aware that this phone that has been buzzing.
Oh, it's with questions.
With
right.
questions.
Well, far away.
That we need to get to.
I don't have any no-go areas.
Okay. I have to put a code in. This is the bit where we challenge your theory that you wouldn't be able to do this and I can. 246810. Okay, I've opened it. Oh, it now looks like your phone because there are 4,798 messages.
Right, okay.
That are all questions for you,
okay.
Annabelle. Oh, okay. I'm just going to take the one from the top.
Okay.
But can we archive these somehow, Bendigo Writers Festival people? Because I actually would really like to see all of them, and I'm not going to be able to... Look, they're coming through as it's happening. Annabelle,
yes?
What advice do you have for Kamala Harris?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, it's always cheap when journalists give advice to politicians because we are the ultimate Monday morning experts, right? And I think, look, by way of analogy, you know, she's the first woman to serve as vice president of the United States. She is the second woman to run as a candidate for a major party. She's encountering... from her opponent, you know, a bunch of the same things that her predecessor encountered. She's being sort of deemed the DEI candidate, you know, the diversity hire, et cetera, which is something that happens to women and something that happens to women of colour even more. So, I don't know, having watched what happened in this country when our first female prime minister had the first crack at this, and when I interviewed her for that series Misrepresented, she was talking about not taking that on, like she didn't want to kind of engage from day one on, right, I'm a lady, I'll be doing lady things, I'll be wearing clothes that won't be dark suits, you know. She was like, I don't want to like mess around with that, I want to like, and she said in an interview for that show, oh, I really wish that on day one I just sort of said, listen people, I'm planning on wearing clothes every day, so can we just get over this sort of what's the jacket like situation? And I think sometimes women do feel like they don't want to engage or whatever. I think that the best defense to all of that stuff is to just be authentic, be the person that you are, like, and because it's always 100 million times easier than trying to be something that keeps you out of trouble with your interesting laugh or your, you know, whatever. There's just a weird thing about women and laughing, mm-hmm. You know. It's being there's a sort of like a narrow range of tones that you can have if you are a woman who's seeking power in your own right. And Hillary Clinton said once that, you know, it's sort of when you go from being the 2IC to like, hello, I'd like the top job now. And was like, whoa, what about your funny laugh? I don't know. And if you get tipped up by that and you're like, oh, I'm not going to laugh anymore, then you look strange and then you add strange to your list of problems. So, yeah.
Then you add sour and embittered.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you, yeah.
Because you're humorless. This yeah. is what women get.
Yeah,
that.
You, yeah. Anyway, this is sort of a bit of a narrow range for men in politics as well. I'm not saying it's just a lady thing, but you know, it'll go away once there's been more.
I'll just talk amongst yourselves while I figure out how to use this phone again. Press this home screen to unlock. Okay, 810.
This is fantastic. This is exactly like it would be if I was doing it.
Oh, I like this one because okay. It nicely loops back to the beginning of the interview and I enjoy the symmetry of that. Reflecting back to a previous topic, what advice would you give your 17-year-old self knowing what you do now about your career trajectory?
Oh, well, I would say a few things. I would say that nightwear is not outerwear. Went through a phase of wearing 90s to uni. But I don't know. I just think, and I would actually say this to anyone of any age, but particularly to young women of that kind of vintage, I think you spend so much time, and I think this has been exacerbated by social media, to be honest, which is a series of platforms that create this really unrealistic sense that you're in the middle of this sphere of scrutiny. Because, you know, when you go on your social media, oh, where's my mentions? What are people saying about me? What are, you know, there's a sort of, it puts you in the centrality of a universe that is, I think, unhelpful, because actually, you know, the vast majority of the world's population is not thinking about you at all. And that's a lovely, comforting thought. Mm. And I think on the other occasion where I've been in the middle of a social media pile on, you know, or some, you know, people are angry that I've interviewed Peter Dutton or whatever, you know, you can feel like everybody thinks that I'm just a terrible person, but actually that's this weird, strange bubble. Actually, most people aren't just not thinking about you at all, at all. And then most of the rest of them are just anxious about themselves. And that's what is happening to teenage people. And I feel if I could somehow create a pill of insight and hand it out that just says, do you know what? Nobody's looking at you. Like, just do your thing. Most of them really aren't noticing. That would be a helpful thing to do.
Annabelle, this person wants to know, oh, what do you mean I've got to press the home screen again?
I am loving this. Can somebody print this out, large print, for Claire?
Well, I can't see it on screen anymore, but I remember what it was. Oh. Annabelle, have you ever thought of running as an MP?
Absolute hard no. I'm too full of doubt. And I think...
Self-doubt, you mean?
No. God, I'm completely obsessed with my own powers. I'm fine. But, like, my great pleasure in life is to talk to people I disagree with and kind of be interested and think, oh, that's interesting. Because, you know, the one thing that really puzzles and worries me about this sort of modern kind of discourse is this idea that, you know, you shouldn't, you know, listen to somebody that you despise or whose ideas you know are just going to be awful. Because, I mean, maybe they will be, and maybe that will confirm you in your own views, and that's a healthy thing, right? You should always stress test your own beliefs, and the easiest way to do that is to hang out with somebody who has a different view. I don't know. I think I would never be able to run for office because I'd be sort of like, on the other hand, this lady is making a kind of interesting point. And then I'd get deselected by the party or whatever, which I'm like, it would just be a disaster. Also, I'm a total gibberer, so I would, you know, never be able to do a concise press conference. And also, I don't like saying things that other people have written for me, and I don't like being yelled at and told to say something.
Sounds like it's not the place for you.
It's not the place for me. Also, I like to watch, Claire.
Okay. Because
I do, because I think... Even back to that whole law school days, I'm just fascinated by the way that people organise themselves. Whether I watch it at school, I watch the PNC people, I watch, you know, councils or sporting teams, just how people in groups organise themselves to do stuff.
And most politicians are not very observant.
Right? Yeah.
Or driven by curiosity.
Well, I think sometimes the skills that you need to bash your way through, particularly the major party system and get pre-selection, are just comedically different from the skills that you need to be a terrific representative. I don't know how we evolved that. Like, it's, yeah.
Because that's now flashing 00 at us, I'm going to ask this last audience question and then I'm going to finish up what I've got.
Okay.
This is a very good... Writers' Festival question. What book do you think Peter Dutton should read?
I think he should read your book.
Hmm. Oh, the one that's about to come out in October.
Oh, well, I haven't read that, but yeah, sure, put that on the pile. Look, I'm suspicious of politicians who don't read. Hmm. I always remember a Liberal Party person saying to me, because it was a moderate person, and this guy said to me, "Oh, Annabelle, I'm a member of the book reading right, not the book burning right." And I thought, "Well, God love you, because I mean, I'm always the ones that write books. I'm not sure. Like when they write one when they're still in office, guaranteed to be boring. You want the one that they write after they leave office." They're always more fun. In fact, when Hillary Clinton wrote her first memoir, it was so boring, I read it and I'm like, you are running for president because this is tedious. Anyway, but I fully approve of politicians who read, because the opportunities to get your brain out of the daily obsession with how am I going, what does everyone think of me, what do you think of me, I mean, they are narrow opportunities, and they're narrowing by the day because our demands that we place on political leaders is, with a 24-hour news cycle, just actually kind of crazy-making. More books.
Annabelle, I'm going to end with this. It's a little fun thing I like to call Fast and Furious.
Oh, good.
I've never done it before. I made it sound like that's what I end all of my interviews on.
Right, yeah,
I just invented it.
Okay.
This is like a kind of linguistic Rorschach's test.
Oh, God.
Okay? So I'm going to give
Rorschach
you...
Rorschach is my favourite artist, but why did he always paint pictures of my parents having sex? Sorry, that's just a funny joke I read recently. I didn't make it up, but it was like...
So I'm going to give you a verbal prompt.
Good.
And you have to reply
with... This
sounds
very unlikely to get me into trouble of any kind.
You have to reply with a one-word answer.
Okay.
Here we go. Hamilton.
Cinnamon. I pre-prepared that.
We're going to start that again. Hamilton.
Earworm. I wake up every morning with a Hamilton song in my head.
Okay. You added a few more words.
I know.
We'll take that.
Earworm is my word.
Shame.
Constant.
Mother.
Lovely.
Sport.
Nope.
Shoes.
Many.
Grief.
Changing.
Cake.
Witch.
Gold Logie.
It just reminds me of going to the Gold Logie, like to the Logies last year with Sales, because she was nominated for the Gold Logie. She looked amazing. She had this black dress on with a sort of like a white sort of... She was very old Hollywood. And I was sitting next to her at the dinner, because it was a dinner, and she couldn't bend over because of the boning. And then she was all kind of like flustery. And she's like, oh, I've dropped my napkin, crab. And then, but the napkin looked exactly like this thing. And so I kept like picking up the end of her thing. And then she'd be like, and I'd be like, shit. It was a comedy routine. And anyway, she didn't win.
Canberra.
Flagpole.
Bendigo.
Love.
And we're out. Mic drop.
How cool is it that we're in a jail?
I know, right?
This building is so cool, and it's such a nice space. Like, these acoustics are perfect.
No, that's what the convicts used to say.
Right? They're just like, how great are these acoustics?
You can hear the screams so well when you're getting flogged.
Anyway, it's good. I like being in places that have been other places and have, like, the echoes of other places but then turn into other things, and that is a good reminder of history and the fact that we should never, ever let it bloody rest. Finish with a profundity. Read her book.
Can you all please thank Annabelle Crabb for her intelligence, her curiosity, and her generosity tonight?
Come here.
Can you also thank, I don't even know if they're backstage anymore, Sarah Soleil and Jazz Bunny for their beautiful poems. Again, thank you to Nay King, our interpreter. I can't even imagine what she was doing during that, some of that. Please enjoy the festival over this weekend. There are so many incredible sessions. Buy books, support authors, and enjoy your festival, Bendigo.
You've been listening to a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri country. You can find out more about the Launches at La Trobe program at the La Trobe University website.